You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, we'll go around the world as Ukraine gets the tanks it's been asking for, unrest rattles Peru, and India's government takes steps to censor a new documentary about its prime minister. But now, we talked on Central Time earlier this week about public schools and school choice coming out of Governor Evers' State of the State address. One of the education issues Evers raised in that speech and early in it was reading proficiency in Wisconsin schools.
We're going to make targeted investments to improve reading and literacy outcomes and expand financial literacy curriculum across our state. We're going to invest $20 million to increase literacy-related programming and implement evidence-based reading practices across Wisconsin.
What do you make of reading and literacy proficiency in Wisconsin? Are you a teacher, a parent, a grandparent, even a kid? What are you seeing and what are you hearing? What are you teaching? What's working and what isn't? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Mark Seidenberg, is a Vilas Professor Emeritus of Psychology at UW-Madison. And Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks.
You research how children acquire reading skills, as well as how the science of reading can help improve educational outcomes. And as somebody who studies this stuff, what was your takeaway from the governor's State of the State address this week?
Well, I was really glad to see him addressing the issue and pledging to do something about it. The one thing that's there's a lot of agreement about in Wisconsin among across party lines and among different participants in this area is that Wisconsin has a reading literacy problem. We don't have enough kids who are succeeding at becoming good readers, and that's a bad thing. So he's been trying to do a lot of things about that during his term as governor and before that at DPI, and I hope he's successful. The question is, how can he be successful given the lack of cooperation that he's had and the lack of cooperation across the aisle that exists?
So there is a politics of reading in Wisconsin. And we had a guest on earlier this week who said that, you know, the part of the problem is we haven't stuck with a solution, that there seems to be a political pendulum that swings back and forth, and literacy, children's literacy, can get caught in the middle of it.
I think that the literacy situation is really just one huge example of how dysfunctional our state government is. I've been here since 2001. I've testified in the state house many times. There have been legislation proposed over the years, none of which actually passed, because we just couldn't get the two parties pulling in the same direction. The last time I testified, which was in 2020, about bills that would address dyslexia and early screening for kids who are at risk for dyslexia, and then addressing the issues that arise for such kids when they're identified, sank because when I testified, the discussion was entirely about politics, and it was not even about the need for this kind of screening or why it was so important to be doing here. So really, if the governor has to go to the legislature for approval for his plans, that's going to be a problem. If he can find a way to spend it on get around that or get the cooperation of the relevant parties, great, because there's a lot that needs to be done.
Mark Seidenberg, are there science of reading laws on the books elsewhere that you've seen that have been that work on behalf of the kids?
They're called science of reading. There's laws. There are laws that are many states, more than 40 at this point, have passed legislation to deal with our literacy crisis in this country. The fact that we're doing such a poor job teaching kids to read, especially among low-income kids and minority kids, but not exclusively. Many states are passing legislation, and I think this legislation is really an expression of exhaustion, of desperation, because the educational establishment has not responded to concerns over the several decades that they have been raised. So states are passing legislation that stipulate what can be taught, how to teach reading, what kind of curricula, which curricula products can be used, and so on. This is a pretty heavy-handed approach, but it's at least forcing the issue. Wisconsin's done nothing on this. And yes, there's a lot that can be learned from what's going on in other states, and Wisconsin has really fallen behind and pretty far.
So how do we get ahead? What's the move forward? What's the steps to take?
Oh, there's so much that could be done if the spirits were only willing. what usually happens is that when money is available or allocated, is that it's spent on things like commercial curricula, which are the textbooks in the classroom, which are produced by the big publishers, and this is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and the textbooks are actually a part of the problem. But nonetheless, one thing that will be done is sort of virtue signaling. You buy the big flashy textbooks and you say, well, see, we're doing something about reading. The solution isn't in the textbooks. It's also not in building the new building. So the other thing that comes up is that people will construct new buildings. So Michael Bloomberg has just announced a new initiative to spend some large number of millions of dollars on building new schools in various states. It's not the schools and it's not the textbooks that are the problem. The problem is what's going on in the classroom to ensure that kids are able to learn to read, get the experiences that will allow them to succeed. Instead of buying the books or building the buildings, we could invest in helping teachers to do the best job they can. And, giving teachers more tools to be more effective in instruction would have a vast impact. So, support the teachers. And there's a variety of ways that could be done.
Mark Seidenberg, our guest, not just Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison, but also the author of Language at the Speed of Sight, how we read, why so many can't, and what can be done about it. And when we spoke earlier this week about the topic, Mark, one of the things that came up is everybody learns to read a little bit differently. And I wonder on you how you see that and how a classroom can benefit a child in helping that.
I think that's basically not true. It's basically an excuse. Look, people's brains are really similar. There's only a couple of kinds of ways that brains learn. We know a lot about them. I've taught and written about them, studied them. And essentially, leaving aside cases of developmental injuries or serious conditions, disabilities, people learn to read essentially the same way. What differs is the kinds of experiences they have. Some have more that are relevant to actually learning about language, learning about print, learning about the world, which are the main things that children need in order to get off the ground. So the experiences vary, but the way people learn is the same. And so the idea that you have to do something different for every snowflake, because, the way that we learn to read is everyone learns to read differently, I think that's really not accurate. In fact, there are certain core things that everybody needs to get and need to be focused on and as effectively as possible.
Are part of our reading outcomes not necessarily dependent on the classroom, but outside the classroom then?
Absolutely. But, it's both, of course. So one thing that has an impact, of course, is socioeconomic status, people's economic circumstances. Another thing that's well established from a lot of different studies is race, ethnicity, basically your some things about race and cultural background, which I've studied myself. And those things can then combine in really powerful ways. So, yes, of course, things outside the classroom matter. Unfortunately, for poor kids, what happens in the school matters a lot because the same resources may not exist in the home or community. And so, public education really needs to do well with those folks because of the lack of resources that they otherwise have. What we're doing is exactly the opposite. We're doing so poorly in teaching kids to read that middle-class parents know that they can't rely on the schools to do all the teaching. They have to either do it at home themselves, or they have to send their kid to a tutor, send them to a learning center, buy some software or use a computer or do something to actually supplement what's going on in the school. I think every parent realizes that they have to do something, be involved actively, almost as, you know, homeschoolers, because they can't just rely on what's happening in the school. Well, those extra activities and going paying for the tutor and so on require a certain kind of resources, and therefore the current situation is just magnifying the impact of socioeconomic differences. We're doing really poorly by making kids worse than they have to be.
We're talking with psychology professor emeritus Mark Seidenberg from UW-Madison, looking at challenges and opportunities around teaching reading in Wisconsin schools. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234, and we will get to your calls. What questions do you have for our expert? Anything we've left out of this conversation that you want to bring to the fore? Please do, 1-800-642-1234, or email us ideas@wpr.org. Your calls when we continue here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up the conversation with Mark Seidenberg, professor emeritus of psychology at UW-Madison, where he researches language acquisition and reading learning, also the author of Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. And we're talking about improving reading performances in Wisconsin schools after Governor Tony Evers highlighted the issue in his State of the State speech earlier this week. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Before we get back to my questions, let's take some of yours. We'll start with Ann and Amory this afternoon. Ann, good afternoon.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a senior citizen, and I would love to go in and help kids read. That's very near and dear to my heart, and I bet there's a lot of other older adults that would do the very same thing. We had that program years ago here in Amory where adults could go in and help kids. And I'm just wondering if that could be done again.
Let's ask Mark Seidenberg. I think my mom would probably have the same question, Mark.
That's a great question. So Wisconsin has had those kind of programs intermittently, not very systematically. Where they've done it really well is in Minnesota. Our friends, the Minnesota Reading Corps, which in fact brings retirees and other capable people into schools to help supplement what is going on in the classroom. Being able to spend additional one-on-one time with kids is really highly effective. So yes, there's a huge pool of resources. AmeriCorps does this. It's just not being done in a very systematic way and or funded in a continuous manner. But I think it's a great thing, and it's underutilized here in Wisconsin.
Continuing your questions for our guest, Mark Seidenberg, at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Dave and Toma next. Dave, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. I almost think even listening to this guy, and this guy sounds like he's smart, he knows what he's talking about, but we've got things backwards now. People used to fight and sneak around and beg for a good education. And now everybody takes it for granted. And if their kid doesn't know something, it's all the school's fault. And I think we should have a program out there that advertises, instead of wasting all this energy saying it's the school's fault, saying, hey, this is a free benefit for everybody. And this is to help you and your kids get ahead and do better than you did. You know, we should be taking advantage of it. And it's a wonderful benefit. And people don't look at it as a benefit anymore.
Thank you, Dave. Are we putting too much blame on teachers in the school system, Mark?
We are. I mean, you know, it's unfortunate. Of course, we're blaming the teachers. I myself go out of my way not to blame the teachers, but I do blame the people who teach the teachers because, you know, what I documented in the book was that teachers aren't adequately prepared for teaching in Wisconsin and throughout the country. This is now pretty widely accepted, and people in various states are taking steps to try to rectify the situation. However, yes, we blame the teachers. The goal would be to give teachers the tools that they need to be able to do the jobs they want to do and succeed. You know, the teachers aren't going into the field to struggle to teach reading, but they are on the first day of the teachers get hired for the job, and on the first day, they are at sea. They have to learn how to teach reading because they weren't taught the relevant stuff as part of their undergraduate education. We need to modify the programs in schools like UW, with Madison and other campuses so that teachers are getting adequate training. I don't think the listener was quite right, because I think parents are avidly interested in having children who read. And, you know, it is that the parents are not experts about classrooms or education or learning. We rely on schools to have people who know what they're doing, who have professional skills. And what we're talking about is trying to improve them so that more kids succeed.
We started this conversation with Governor Tony Evers' State of the State address and his call for spending more money specifically on dealing with reading achievement in Wisconsin. Mark, if we gave you the state's purse strings here, how would you spend some of that money?
Well, the first thing is I would not spend it on new curricula, these commercial curricula from the big publishers. The solution is not in those products. There is no magic there. In fact, historically, they've been part of the problem. So just don't buy a new... Don't spend the money for the sake of spending it on these books. I have two suggestions. One is who's going to go into the teaching profession? We've made it into a profession in which people get blamed. Teachers were demonized in this state, you know, in the Walker administration with various things that we all remember. And people complain about the cost of higher education. So my suggestion is, through some combination of government and private philanthropy, find a way to provide full scholarships for people who go into teaching on the condition that they stay in the field at least 5 years or 7 years. We would attract people, and we would have additional time perhaps to give them good educations, because they don't have to worry about paying for their college and rushing to get out. So I think scholarships for future teachers that allow them to graduate debt-free with a commitment to stay in the schools and be, you know, with and obtain additional in-service support would be really, really a game changer. The other thing is, we're all focused on what happens to kids in schools, but, you know, the die is cast a little earlier than that. All the things that lead up to school really have a huge impact. In particular, there's a lot of variability in what children learn about language, and there's a lot of variability in what they learn about the world, the things we use language to talk about. So on the first day of school, there are already a lot of kids who are behind, and it's really hard to catch up. So we need to have pre-K programs we don't need we need better pre-K programs, and there's a lot that can be done in the pre-K year or year and a half. It's not starting to teach reading earlier. That's not the point. That's not going to be helpful. What could be done is exposing the kid to a broader range of uses of language, vocabulary, words that we use to talk about subjects like animals and dinosaurs and where people live in different parts of the world. So pre-K, experiences of children before they even get to school that reading builds on, that's where kids are behind, and that's where we could do a huge amount. And I don't see that happening, and it frustrates me a great deal.
What's your position on standardized testing and the assessments that's done so we can find out where kids are at in their reading abilities?
Well, we had a period in which they were overused and they were really clumsy. There's a difference between that kind of testing that you're referring to. There's a difference between that and, you know, you can do short assessments just to track kids' progress, which is actually much easier to do now with software. That we also buy. It's not the standardized testing, you know, the data that tell us how well kids are doing, like on the NAEP in reading, are very important. They're just giving us information about how we're doing. The standardized testing that was intended to say, you know, kids have to reach a certain level on the test before being allowed to move forward or something like that. That was really not working out. That was a mistake. What you need are quick and non-intrusive assessments that track the real skills, progress on the real skills that underlie reading. That I'm all for, and software technology can be used to make that happen.
Mark Seidenberg, our guest, professor emeritus at UW-Madison. And before we run out of time here with just a couple minutes left, I want to mention that you'll be taking part in a summit on early literacy from the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership. It's coming up February 8th in Madison. Why is this important, Mark?
Well, the people at the Thompson Center have brought in several of us who have been working on these issues for a number of years now, several years now, and in states across the country. So we have a lot of experience with what's happening elsewhere and the kinds of things that work and don't work. Emily Hanford will be there. She's done a very influential series of audio documentaries on American public media that really have turned people's heads and opened their eyes about the literacy crisis in this country. She'll be there. I'll be there to talk about research and ways to connect the research to practice. Kimiana Burke, who has been involved in an effort in Mississippi and Arkansas and a number of other states to raise literacy among the poorest of kids, will also be there. She's a powerhouse. And our own Donna Heidmanek, who was a teacher in Wisconsin and Illinois schools for 40 years, and then started a group on Facebook called The Science of Reading, What I Should Have Learned in College, which now has almost 200,000.
Hey, Mark, I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Mark Seidenberg, professor emeritus at UW-Madison, also the author of Language at the Speed of Sight. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. You're with us on the Ideas Network, and coming up, it's Food Friday. People around the world are celebrating the Lunar New Year or Chinese New Year, and we're going to try out some Chinese dishes at home. We'll be making authentic Chinese cuisine from the comfort of our own kitchen. But first, we're getting tips and tricks on how to get your home organized and keep it that way through 2023. Getting started on decluttering and organizing can be extremely overwhelming, so we have two professional organizers here to help us. How can they help get control of your home's chaos? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. What are your methods for decluttering? How do you even let go of stuff? We want to hear your ideas. And once you've decluttered, how do you go about keeping it that way? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation, or you can always email us, ideas@wpr.org. Casey Fregoso is a professional organizer and the founder of Bracket and Bin Organizing based in Madison, Wisconsin. Casey, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Kate Fisher is a certified professional organizer and the founder of The Neatest, based in Durham, North Carolina, where she relocated after living in Madison for 7 years. Kate, welcome back to Wisconsin.
It's so great to be back. Thanks for having me.
And let's start with just an overview or some philosophy. Before we get into specifics, I'd like to hear each of your philosophies on home and what you think a home should feel like and look like and be organized for. Casey, I'll start with you.
Yeah, so my philosophy on a home is that it's just kind of your sanctuary. It's the place you should be able to go when everything else kind of gets chaotic and overwhelming, like outside of your home. So for me, the biggest thing is making your home being like very comfortable. You want to make sure it doesn't bring more stress and more chaos. It should be a place kind of as your refuge. That's what I would think your home should be.
A sanctuary and a refuge. Kate?
Oh, I echo what she says 100%. You know, your home is where you feel safe and it's where you just want to be. So so when you are in a situation where you feel a little bit cluttered or like things need to change, it makes it feel a little less like your home. So that's where we step in.
And how do we set some goals for the organizing, decluttering, and keeping it that way? Kate, how do we go about that?
Setting goals. Well, I mean, so the goals that I typically come across when I meet new clients are that they want better functionality. Sometimes they want beauty. Sometimes it's just as general as make it less bad. or just like get rid of stuff. So your goal can be super simple. It doesn't have to be something that is uber specific.
And Casey, give us some idea of how we can set goals and decide what we want to change in our homes.
Yeah. So a good way to set a goal is to, I think the first thing to do is kind of be a little bit introspective and think of ways that you can avoid like your own pitfalls. So if you're someone who likes to create piles on every open surface in your home, like with junk mail, books, etc., it's probably best that you try to remove extra like entry tables that you don't necessarily need. Or if you have like a chair in your bedroom that you pile all your clothes onto, maybe just get rid of that if you're never really sitting in it. So I think making goals that pertain to specific rooms and then trying to create systems that can help maintain those goals.
So I have a chair in my bedroom that I've actually never sat on, but all my clothes have fallen there at one point or another. It's basically another dresser. What would you recommend I do with it?
Yeah, so I would just say take it out of that room. Put it in a room that you would actually sit in it. Or I would just say get rid of it completely, donate it or toss it, because it's just like a clutter magnet then. And then anything that really goes into the chair, if it's like, oh, it's not dirty, but it's not clean clothes, because I know that's what people usually put on their chairs. maybe come up with another system of like a basket in your closet that you can rewear, or make a habit of hanging it back up or folding it and putting it back in the drawer it belongs in.
That was my very next question. If I get rid of the chair, where will my clothes go?
You got to find a spot.
Our guest, our professional organizer, is Casey Fregoso and Kate Fisher, joining us to help you declutter and stay organized through 2023. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234 and your thoughts at email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Kathy in Madison. Kathy, you're on the air.
Well, hi. So my issue is I'm one of those clutterers. But my stuff has got value, and if I sell it like on eBay or something, then it's considered earned income, I think, and that would be a concern for me because I'm on Obamacare. They look at my income carefully for my premiums. So what do you do in that situation? Is there a way of getting money for your stuff you don't use anymore that you know is valuable, but not getting taxed again on it?
Interesting. So cluttering, you've got stuff that's worth stuff. It's worth something. And if you were to sell it on eBay, it would be an income for you and you'd be taxed on that. So I guess this falls under decluttering. And Kate Fisher, I'll ask you, what do we need to consider when it comes to declutter, especially when we're considering that the stuff that we have has value?
Well, okay. So first of all, when you go to sell something, I mean, there are lots of outlets on eBay, or if it's closed, you can take things around to secondhand stores and whatnot. You've got to set a time, like a set some a date on your calendar, and just say, be very real with yourself and say, if I have not sold it by this date, that, or I have not made an effort to sell it, then I probably am not going to do that. And so it still just becomes clutter in your house and it's still not valuable. But deciding what stays and what goes is a very personal thing. And, you know, you want to think about things like frequency of use. You know, have you used it in the last year or 5 years? is it broken? Is it gross? Would you actually fix it? And that's another thing where you set a date on your calendar, and if it hasn't been fixed, you get rid of it. Do you like it? You know, a big thing that's around is Spark Joy, you know, from Marie Kondo. And I think that she's fantastic. And, you know, I don't maybe not necessarily think of it as spark joy, but just, do you like it? You know, is it a coffee mug with a handle that's too thin, or is something chipped, or is it something that somebody gave you that you don't really like anymore, like that person? So you don't have to feel obligated to keep things that are freebies or things that people gave you.
And I can totally see where Kathy's coming from. But Casey Fregoso, I'll follow up with you how we get through some of these emotions of decluttering and the guilt that can come with getting rid of things that mean something to you or have memories associated with them, that if I were to get rid of these things, I would worry my memories might go with them as well.
Yeah, I do have a lot of people, honestly, like when deciding to become organized, I always say start with things that you're not so attached to. So a good go-to place is like either the junk drawer or your pantry, because usually people aren't attached to like a can of beans. So you can decide if it's expired. It's easy to get rid of. So I always say start there, because then you can start learning the process of it before you get into the things that you have sentimental attachments to. But when it comes to sentimental attachments, kind of what Kate was saying too, I think it's really not beneficial or healthy to keep things out of obligation just because, oh, so-and-so got this for me. But yeah, like she said, like we don't talk anymore, or we're not friends, or I just don't like it. Like I love the person, but what they gave me is not something I like. So I think being introspective and real with yourself and letting yourself know, like, maybe I don't need to hang on to this. You can even have like a maybe bucket where you're like, I think I want to get rid of this, put it all in there, maybe hide it for a little time, or go off and say, I'm going to come revisit this and see if it is still something that I could live without. But just letting yourself, like being kind to yourself and understanding that you don't have to keep things that you don't want, even if, you know, society or, you know, your family is like, why are you getting rid of that? It is your life. It's your home. You want to make it what you want it to be.
Mm-hmm. And if I could jump in, there is a thing that I like to call the purgatory box that I've created with a few of my Madison clients. So hi, if you're out there, you know who you are. But what I call a purgatory box is for those things that you really are having a tough time making a decision with. And so you put it in an opaque box and label it purgatory. And then you put a date on your calendar with a little reminder that says, what's in the purgatory box? If you can remember what's in there, you're allowed to keep it. And if you can't remember what's in there, then you take it straight to Goodwill.
Oh, that's so a maybe bucket or a purgatory box. Both of those tools could help you decluttering. And we're talking with professional organizers Kate Fisher, founder of The Neatest, and Casey Fregoso, founder of Bracket and Bin Organizing. And we're talking about how to get your home decluttered and organized in the new year. And we want to hear from you here at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our professional organizers this afternoon? What methods have you found that work for you or don't work? Have you tried the purgatory box or the maybe bucket? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Email us, ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and we're picking up our conversation with professional organizers Kate Fisher of The Neatest and Casey Fregoso of Bracket and Bin Organizing. They're sharing tips on how to organize your home and keep it that way, and we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What do you need to know about how you can keep organized throughout the new year here? You can also email us, ideas@wpr.org, or call 1-800-642-1234. Okay, Casey Fregoso, now we have decluttered. What's the first step in beginning to organize?
Yeah, so my biggest, or the biggest thing I see people make the mistake of buying right away. I mean, I guess once you've decluttered, you can definitely measure and put the bins in there. But just before you declutter, make sure you don't go out and purchase a bunch of new bins, just because you're going to have even more clutter to the organization that you're trying to get to. But once you've decluttered and you're ready to organize, you'll want to kind of categorize everything so that you know what categories you have, where they're going to live, like on your shelf or in your closet, in your cabinets. And then you can come up with ways to keep them. So if you want to get a bin or just like shelf dividers, I think it just depends what you're organizing, and you want to keep thinking outside of the box. You don't have to do everything in the same type of bin or everything looking the same. Do you have any other tips, Kate?
Oh, sure. I think the accessibility is super important, you know, and think about how often you use something. So the things that you use the most often are going to need to be within easy reach. And, you know, so think about, do I use it every day, every week, every month? And then the easiest way to go from that is, what do I hardly ever use? And that's the stuff that you're going to want to put in the nooks and crannies that are deep recesses and whatever. And then you fill in between. But always make sure that the stuff that you wear the most, use the most, is within easy reach.
Let's go back to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. Joyce and Madison, good afternoon.
Hi. This is Joyce.
Hi, Joyce.
Can you hear me? Hi. Okay. I have an unusual thing. I have quite a bit of antique clothing that my dear grandmother saved, and I don't want it anymore, but I'd rather donate it, like, to a historical society or something. And what is the general way to get in touch with, like, not Wisconsin Historical Society? I would feel comfortable with that, but like Illinois Historical Society. Have you got any recommendations?
Interesting, Joyce. And it's another question about the value of things that we have that you know, may have value to others, and how to share that value with others. Casey, any ideas?
I think Kate has an idea.
Yeah, sure. So I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in everything, but what I do when I have a client that has something very specific is I, as a professional organizer, reach out to my network of people and say, hey, because I'm in an association, the National Association of Professional Organizers and Productivity Specialists. It's really awesome. And so I message out to them and say, hey, guys, what do you think? And usually there are lots of responses. And so what I would do is reach out to a professional organizer in your area, you know, maybe reach out to Casey, or if you want to contact me after the show, I can help you. Finding a specific resource for you is really important, and I rely on vetted resources from other professionals.
Yeah, I appreciate that call, Joyce, as well as the response. And let's continue with this. We'll go now to Anne in Duluth. Anne, good afternoon. You're on the air with Kate Fisher and Casey Fragoso.
Hi. Just before you came on the air, I was walking around part of my living room with a box, picking up my grandchildren's toys that they no longer play with. I tried to have them help me decide what to keep and what to give away, but they were hoarders and they took some of it home. So I decided to act on my own. And I'm sure their mom doesn't appreciate it. But my main point that I called about is this. I would really rather give my things away to somebody who needs them than have them sitting in a drawer where I may or may not use them again. And we have a center here that provides meals for people, clothing. They have a clothing room for people who are trying to get a job. They have they accept toys and clothing for children. And I never feel bad getting rid of my stuff when I know it's going directly to help someone.
Oh, I very much appreciate that perspective. And Casey Fragoso, there is this decluttering, this organizing, it all comes with these feelings we have that if we get rid of this stuff, we're getting rid of something that could be useful to others or that has value to others or it's got value to me. And sometimes the disorganization comes with that feeling of dread and, oh my gosh, it's just chaos over here. How do you deal with the feelings as a professional organizer?
Yeah, I mean, it's like a saying with professional organizers, like it's not just about the stuff. It's always the stuff underneath the stuff. So I always make sure I'm going at the pace of my client. We never want to go too fast and kind of push past all of the attachments we have to things. So I just tell them to kind of take it step by step, you know, start with the simple things. If you feel like it has a lot of value, but you know your family, you or your family aren't going to use it, kind of like the caller said too, like Ann said, you can look for donations, like donation centers, local shelters. I mean, daycares will sometimes take some old toys that are gently used. You mm-hmm. can definitely think of other places to bring those things to. And it does make you feel better inside because now you know somebody else is benefiting from it. That thing is living another life with somebody else. And I think that helps create less feeling of like dread when you're getting rid of things.
That's Casey Fragoso from Bracket and Bin Organizing. Also joining us, Kate Fisher from The Neatest. And you can join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. And Kate, I understand you specialize in your expertise is people with ADHD. What tips can you share for decluttering and organizing for people who have ADHD?
Okay, so I've got it. My daughter has it. and it's a very passionate subject of mine. But typically, I mean, really just neurodiversity in general with people. But with ADHD, your struggles are stemming from executive dysfunction. And so if you read up on executive functions of your brain, it has to do with things like multi-step planning, working memory, emotional regulation, and attention. And so you try and think of ways to combat that. And I think that having a partner to help you is super important. Even if you don't hire a professional, have a really trusted, non-judgmental friend or family member, or you know, if your dog lends you support, that's great too. But your partner can help keep you on track. They can hold things up for you, so you don't have this. There's this thing called tactile sympathy, where when you touch something, it brings back all these memories and you're less objective about it. And that's a way for someone with ADD or ADHD to go down a path and like get stuck. So so someone can hold stuff up for you. Make it fun. Having fun playing games is so, so important. Put on some music. And then also make things really obvious while you're organizing and sorting through things. And then when you're organizing things back into your space. So what I mean by that is use some big bold post-it notes that say things like, these are my donations. This is recycling. This is trash. This is stuff that I want to ask somebody about. And so you don't forget which pile is which, or which box is which. And it helps keep you on track. Also, small focus. Don't think about doing like a whole entire room all in one day. Focus on a drawer. Focus on a desk. Focus on something that is small and manageable that can take you an hour or less. And if you take little small bites, then that will help you achieve your problem in a more realistic way. I mean, achieve your goal in a more realistic way.
Kate Fisher from The Neatest there. Also our guest, Casey Fragoso from Bracket and Bin Organizing. And Casey, once we've decluttered and once we've taken those first steps in organizing, you know, there is this entropy where it just starts to happen all over again. How can we maintain our organization throughout the year?
Yeah, so my biggest tip for that is just creating systems for things that routinely will enter your home. So I like to always give the example of your child goes to a birthday party and they come home with a bunch of little party favors and things like that. So I've had a lot of parents make a rule that these favors get to live in our house for 24 hours and you can play with them. And then after that, they can be donated, or if they're, you know, used little tattoos or something, they can be tossed. Or even for kids' artwork, you can create a place to display their newest masterpiece. And then after a new one comes in, you can swap it out and display that one. And then you can have a memory box to keep all your favorites. Or you can even use, I would also think of using digital apps and things like that, so that it creates less clutter, physical clutter in your home. Mm-hmm.
We'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank you both for joining us today. Casey and Kate, thank you both.
Oh, thank you. It was great.
Casey Fragoso, founder of Bracket and Bin Organizing, and Kate Fisher is the founder of The Neatest, talking to us today about decluttering, organizing, the feelings that come with that, and then keeping it that way throughout the year. Now, coming up after the news, it's Food Friday, and our guest is here today to talk about Chinese cuisine. Dishes in your kitchen that even I could make. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.